from 7am each morning. The One Love Breakfast, live from Rio on GFM, Ujima Radio and BCFM 93.2.
Here's the way they look at it. Here's their metaphor. Adam and Eve were held prisoner in the Garden of Eden by an unjust, cruel, and vindictive God until Lucifer, through his agent Satan, set man free from this garden by giving him the gift of intellect. Through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land. Every secret brotherhood, every secret society, every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. After his party's terrible showing in last month's local and European elections, Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg is pinching himself. Am I really still here? Nick Clegg staying on as Liberal Democrat leader till next May's general election is likely to only really help the Tory party. So is Clegg clinging on to his day in the sun for the Tories' sake? Has he not only ditched the electorate, but his own party's members too? So with a new leader and the blessing of the membership, the Lib Dems do stand a chance of holding office again. So since everybody knows Clegg's a big turn-off for the voters, why not give one of the rising political stars a chance? Well, anyway, this week we take a look at the Lib Dem leader, Nick Clegg, and ask, why is this albatross still running the party? And joining me is a former leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council. That's Steve Comer. Hi, Steve, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Now, I know you've been fairly vociferous about the idea that there should be a re-election of a leader in the Liberal Democrats. Why is that?
I think the problem we've got into now is that Nick Clegg, for a lot of people, personifies why they've moved away from the Liberal Democrats and what they don't like about us. And I think we do need something of a relaunch. It's 11 months for the general election, and the best way to do that is to have a change of leader, and what goes with that is perhaps a little bit of a change of emphasis in the run-up, because I think there is a problem, and I think one of the difficulties that Nick Clegg has is it's not always easy to distinguish when he's Deputy Prime Minister and when he's leader of the Liberal Democrats. Now, for some reason, I don't really know why, but David Cameron seems to be able to perform that trick somewhat better.
Okay, so what's the actual procedure within the Liberal Democrats for triggering some kind of leadership contest? Because it would seem to make sense for the vast majority of Lib Dems, if they want to have a good showing at the general election next year, to at least have the opportunity to choose a new leader.
I think that's right. There's basically three ways you get a leadership election. Either a leader resigns, half the parliamentary...
Do politicians resign these days?
Well, Min Campbell resigned, and that caused the last leadership election. So, yes, it does happen. Charles Kennedy resigned in not quite such auspicious circumstances, and that caused the one before. So, yes, leaders do resign. Paddy Ashton resigned the leadership. So, yes, that does happen. The other way is there's a vote of half the parliamentary party, or 75 local parties pass a resolution calling for a leadership election.
Okay, 75
election.
Out of how many?
75, well, is how many constituencies are there? Over 600. Take the Northern Ireland ones out, because we don't organise there, then it's 75 out of 600 and something.
Okay, so that hasn't happened, though. So it does make you wonder whether there really is this feeling amongst ordinary members that it's worth having a new leader.
I think there's an increasing feeling amongst ordinary members that that we need to do this. I think the difficulty is, obviously, the organisational bar is set highly to stop frivolous challenges. But I think there is a recognition. But equally, within any political party, there's always loyalty to a leadership. And I think that is quite powerful for a lot of people as well. And I know that there are a lot of people who are genuinely torn about what is the best way forward.
OK, amongst Lib Dems, what do they see as the positives and negatives about Nick Clegg? Let's start with the negatives, because that's the most obvious, you know, especially when we're talking about the idea that, you know, he has really just lost spectacularly in an election for the Europe and the local elections. And so what have Lib Dems identified as the reasons for that?
Well, I think the main weakness as far as Nick Clegg is concerned is he's actually presided over several years worth of bad election results. This is a bit like a football manager. You know, if you lose a load of games on the trot, then the fans start demanding change. And I think, you know, this has not been a few games, this has been a few years. And so I think that's the problem. For me, one of the negatives is that the difficulty is he looks and sounds very much part of the Westminster establishment club, as indeed do Miliband and Cameron. But I think one of the strengths Liberal Democrats had with ordinary voters is that we looked and sounded different, looked and sounded as if we weren't quite comfortable in the club, and were in some way oppositional or an alternative option to the rather stifling, cosy Westminster consensus. Nick Clegg looks like that's where he's happy, and I think that's a major problem. In terms of positives, then you could say, I mean, what is said about him by his supporters is that he's got a good intellect. He is personally quite a likable bloke, actually. I mean, I've met him a few times, and he is quite personable and likable. As I say, he is intelligent, and they say he led us into government. I'm not sure he did, actually, because the only reason the Liberal Democrats ended up in the government was that no one party had an overall majority, and a combination of two parties did give a working majority. But that's not him leading us there. That's him being in post when it happened.
Just one thing about the whole coalition, right from the very start in 2010, was, I mean, my feeling is, I mean, I've looked, you know, historically at coalition governments, and it may be going back a long, long way, but back in the 1880s, Irish MPs held the balance of power in Westminster in a similar way, and they managed to extract the most incredible changes for Ireland in those years. They forced the government, they basically said to them, either of the main parties, the Whigs or the Tories it was in those days, that supports us, we'll support them in everything else they want to do, but we want this. And we haven't really had that from Nick Clegg. We seem to have had more giving up on the party manifesto that they went into the 2010 election. Just as an example of what these Irish MPs managed to extract in the 1880s, was they managed to get government loans all over the south of Ireland for people to buy and build their own homes, where they had just suffered the famine, you know, a couple of decades before, to turn them into owner occupiers with nice new houses, paying less interest on the money they were paying, the loans repay, than they were to the old absentee landowners. So they're an amazing change in Ireland, and one of the main reasons Ireland is such a nice place today in the Republic is because we've got lots and lots of small owner occupiers right across the place. That's what those Irish MPs managed to extract for one Parliament's deal in Westminster. What has Nick Clegg managed to extract?
Oh, I think there have been a lot of successes coming out of the coalition.
Let's hear some positives.
Raising the tax threshold was a clear Lib Dem demand. David Cameron said before the election it couldn't possibly be done, and it has been done. Some of the changes to pensions with auto-enrolment and some of the more flexibility of people with private pensions as to what they can do with it and when, I think that's been very positive. The pupil premium in terms of schools has brought a lot of money into schools where there are children who have, you know, multiple deprivations. So there have been some positive developments that you know, are due to the Liberal Democrat influence in coalition. And I actually think the coalition agreement itself has pretty sound and has stood the test of time. What's hurt us is the guilt by association with all the stuff that wasn't in the coalition agreement, like top-down NHS reform, the under-occupancy charge, or otherwise known as the bedroom tax, all the Michael Gove stuff with free schools and so on. None of that was our policy. And yet we appear to be getting the blame for it, because I think that tactically, you know, we didn't put the right distance in place, and we didn't deliver on some of the constitutional changes that we wanted, most notably reform of the House of Lords.
What about Danny Alexander, though? Because he's been regularly accused of out-Torying the Tories. He's supposed to be a Lib Dem.
Yeah, I think there is a problem with an element within the Liberal Democrats. We're now on the 10th anniversary of the publication of the thing called the Orange Book. And I think we have to accept that there was quite an organised element who wanted to move the party, certainly in economic policy terms, if not in social policy terms, to the right. And I think that's been quite organised and quite effective. I think, as far as the membership concerns, there have always been a fairly a minority current. But as we saw with Tony Blair and New Labour, actually, if you get hold of the levers, then you can make that change. And in many ways, I think what we've seen over the last 10 years in the party really is a bit like a slow motion replay of New Labour.
Yeah, there's a headline. This is from the 3rd of February this year. Lib Dems accused Danny Alexander of going native at the Treasury as he backs George Osborne's plans for more spending cuts. I mean, do you think people, as they get close to number 10, close to these positions of power, are simply offered directorships after they leave office and then they start to become creatures of the city?
Well, certainly they seem to end up with directorships, whether they're offered in advance or are bestowed later, I don't know. But I mean, a former Labour defence minister ended up standing down from Parliament and then ended up, guess what, on the board of a defence contractor. So obviously, you know, the networking and the links that go on within the Westminster bubble probably preserve people. But you see, what bothers me about this is the fate of the party across the whole country, because there is another historical precedent. You mentioned the Irish Nationalists under Parnell and co. There is another historical precedent of a group of people who were very concerned about maintaining power and being in government, and you know, they had 30 or 40 MPs for a couple of decades and then disappeared, and they were the Liberal Nationals. And one of the dangers, what happened there, was that they were very Westminster based people. The organisation that sustain them at a local level collapsed, and once the electoral pact with the Tories ended, then they ended up being virtually, well, they were assimilated by the Tory party, as were the Liberal Unionists in the period when Ireland was an issue that you referred to.
What about the whole business of tuition fees, though? Hasn't that just been a complete disaster with all these young people you are hoping to recruit to start voting for you over the next decades? I mean, left en masse, haven't they? Because we now know that a deal was done with David Cameron before the election even to say that tuition fees would be increased, not what we were being told before the general election.
I think part of the problem was that those negotiating the coalition agreement, I think, were unaware of just how attached the party in the country was to the policy we went into the general election with. Now, you know, circumstances do change and people do have to backtrack on things. I mean, Labour never trailed the introduction of tuition fees in the manifesto before they brought them in, and yet they did it. So I think part of it is presentational. In actual fact, strangely, with the tuition fee system we've got, it's actually better than the one that preceded it in a lot of ways. And it is more or less a deferred graduate tax. But they couldn't call it a deferred graduate tax because the Tories wouldn't accept the name, but I think we should have used, I think it's presentation, you see, we should have used that terminology and said, look, this is not a million miles away from what the National Union of Students were suggesting in their run-up to the elections, and we could have moved on from there. But I think, yeah, it was a seminal moment, but I don't think it's the issue itself, actually. I think it's almost, and I think there's been a subtle change. I mean, I've been door-knocking in all the elections since the coalition has formed, and whereas in 2011 I think there was a real anger amongst some of our voters that we'd form the coalition, I don't think that's the case now. I think people accept that the coalition is there, and the arithmetic meant there could only logically be one coalition if there wasn't to be a grand coalition of Tory and Labour. But I think the problem we've got now is not so much the gone in with the Tories allegation, it's part of the establishment allegation. You know, we look as if we're comfortable in the Westminster Club.
Okay.
And I think
Let's cut to the chase, Steve. Give us a couple of names you think would make good new leaders for the Lib Dems, hopefully before the next general election.
Well, I mean, it would have to be someone who's currently within the parliamentary party, obviously. And there are lots of names. You could, depending on whether you're looking at a short-term or a long-term option, if you're looking at a short-term option, Vince Cable's a possible runner. If you're looking at a long-term replacement, which I think would be better, you know, there's Tim Farron, there's Lynn Featherston. You know, I mean, you can go on and on. There are probably others who are less well known who might put their hats in the ring. I mean, we're not short of talent, and I would be prepared to accept a compromise where the party has a new leader, and if you had the election now, that could happen in time for the autumn. And Nick Clegg, if he feels he's got to stay as Deputy Prime Minister, then he stays in that role. I would be quite open to that as a compromise, but unfortunately, I think. Either Nick Clegg wants to cling on, or the people advising him are desperate for him to cling on.
Okay, also, Nick Clegg and his rise to power, because that was all a little bit strange, I felt. And I know there was, Min Campbell in between? But when Charles Kennedy was sort of elbowed out, it did seem that he was quite an independent-minded guy. Yes, he was a bit of a drinker. He probably still is a bit of a drinker. But Winston Churchill, during the Second World War, was a bit of a drinker. So how did Nick Clegg get that nomination? I know, you know, you've noticed, and I've noticed, that some of the figures that pushed for him were part of this Bilderberg organisation we were covering the other week, really an international elite.
Yes, and it's interesting that the names crop up. I mean, Nick Clegg was a bright, fairly ambitious member of the European Parliament, elected in the for the 1999 to 2004 European Parliament. He didn't seek re-election in 2004 because he was selected for Sheffield Hallam. And it's interesting because of what's happened over the last couple of weeks. I've made contact with some other Liberal Democrats that I didn't know, and bits more of the jigsaw are put together. It was very clear that fairly early on in his tenure as a MEP that leading lights and grandees within the party sort of almost anointed him as the boy who must be king.
I remember they did this with Blair in the Labour Party, didn't they, in the early 90s?
The parallels are quite scary. But yes, that's exactly what happened. And I think the intention that they had was that Charles Kennedy would do the 2005 2005 Parliament out, and then Nick Clegg would replace them. Well, of course, they then felt they had a problem because Nick was only elected to Parliament in 2005, and you know, Kennedy's problems became such that in the end, his position became untenable, and he resigned. And at that stage, I think the grandees wanted Min Campbell as a sort of safe option, safe pair of hands to cover the period up to the general election. And when that was clear that, you know, Min... This is a problem sometimes when you move people. You know, we lost our best foreign affairs spokesman person we'd ever had, and gained somebody who wasn't that effective as a party leader. And I think when that was seen not to be working, 18 months in, Min himself decided to go. And at that stage, Clegg stood. And of course, in the election that Min Campbell won, Simon Hughes and Chris Huhne also stood. And then when Min went, it was Chris versus Nick Clegg. But it was a very odd leadership election. A lot of the grandees in the party, I think, believed the polls and thought Nick Clegg was going to walk this by 2-1. In actual fact, he ended up winning by 500. And
just what sort of a margin is that in terms of percentage?
Well, I mean, the membership of the party at the time was probably about 70,000.
Okay,
so I mean,
really,
you know, you're within
1%. Yeah.
And in fact, there was a postal strike in London, and a question was asked as to whether the deadline on the postal ballot should be extended for a day to allow for that.
Well, these grandees, they were actually Bilderberg attendees, were they?
Well, I think they had been in the past. I mean, if you look, you know, who was promoting Nick Clegg? Paddy Ashdown, Shirley Williams, you know, others of that generation.
Certainly those two have
who
been,
had been
Bilderberg
attendees. Yeah. I believe Nick Clegg himself has also been an attendee. And, you know, there is a link again with the Blair experience with that. So whether that is the a link that's more than coincidental. I don't know, but it is quite interesting that, you know, you come back to this, you know, rather secretive organisation that claims it isn't an organisation of the great and the good across Europe and North America.
So what does that tell you about how way politics really works? Because, I mean, you know, you've also got the media involved in Bilderberg, and the media absolutely instrumental in this campaign against Charles Kennedy, for example.
Yes, very much so, and I don't know, I don't know why they took against Charles Kennedy quite the way he did. As you said, he wouldn't have been the first person to have had in politics to have had personal problems of one form or another, and yet you know, they seemed to round on him. I think part of the explanation might be where the party was positioned at that time, because bear in mind this was 2005-06 when the whole Kennedy thing blew up. The Liberal Democrats had been the only party that had opposed the Iraq war, were known to be cynical about the demands of the security services on the so-called war in terror. We opposed 90-day detention. You know, we always had strong civil liberty credentials and that, and obviously those who were the opposite side of those arguments probably didn't like that.
Okay, finally then, Steve, what do you think your thoughts are over whether there will be any kind of leadership contest between now and next May?
I think it's possible, but I think it's less likely. And the danger is, you know, there used to be an old adage about the captain always goes down with the ship. I think if Clegg stays, I worry that the ship will go down with the captain. But, you know, I there are a lot of us who want change, and we're now starting to organise and talk to each other.
Isn't
better.
It a bit demoralising when you can see that there's actually quite a lot of people in the party that do want a new leader to take you into the next election and nothing's happening?
Well, I think it is demoralising. What's actually more demoralising is, you know, conversations you have with people who used to support us. And I mean, in the elections this year, it was very noticeable that they knocked on a lot of doors and people said, look, we like what you're doing locally, we like your sitting councillor, we're going to vote for you in the local elections, but not in the Euros, because we don't like either Nick Clegg personally or the way the coalition is being presented. And I think that's a real problem.
Well, I don't think Nick Clegg's alone in not really being liked much by the electorate. Anyway, Steve Comer, thanks very much for joining us.
Unity FM is a registered charity, which means we're not for profit. And we're now able to support local business by offering low-cost promotional announcements and adverts about your business or products. You can even sponsor a show, event or outside broadcast. So why not support the station that supports the communities of Bristol? And contact us today to find out more. BCFM 93.2 FM. Bristol is our community.
Well, I'm joined now by Kevin Phillips from Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Tony.
Kevin, you were at this recent conference, weren't you, a few weeks ago, with Theresa May giving you a lecture. Tell us, what was she saying?
Well, let's put it this way. At the end of the lecture, it certainly felt as though we should have been doing 10 minutes detention at the end of the day. I thought it was a little bit unnecessary. We are going through an independent review. We've agreed to take on the independent review to look into the workings of the Police Federation. And I thought it was a little bit of a harsh speech that she gave at the time.
Now, I must admit, I don't understand one aspect to it. She was saying they're pulling funding from the Police Federation. Now, does that mean that your organisation is no longer going to get any funding from the Home Office and just have to rely on fees from your members?
Well, effectively, what is happening, that is a small sum in respect of the Police Federation. Currently, or last year, it was somewhere around £300,000, which pays for a lot of the issues to do with the principal officers based at Leatherhead. That is reducing to about £100,000 this year, and by 2015 that will be phased out completely. That is a very small sum, but it was a headline grabber for obviously the government and Theresa May.
Okay, and tell me, how is the Federation being told it's got to reorganise, and what exactly is going on?
Well, basically, the Federation runs on, and it's a very historical thing. It was set up by Parliament, by an Act of Parliament. It is set up with three rank boards and a central committee. That has now been dissolved. We have made that decision at conference, the last conference we've just done. It will be rankless, and we will work together for the benefit of our members.
Well, that's interesting, because it means that from now on, there's going to be no distinguishing between, say, an inspector level and a constable level.
Absolutely. The ranks will still be there within the police service, but within the police federation, there will be no specific rank boards. It will be a central funding. It will all the money will go to the centre, and it will be dealt with. Everybody will be dealt with on parity.
Now, just give us an idea of how democratic actually is the police federation. I mean, you get the idea that it's not in the ordinary trade union tradition, where it's a completely separate body from the profession. Because I'm really not sure about this. So, just give us an idea of how democratic it is and how you make decisions in the federation.
Well, I think what you've got to look at is the way the police federation is set up, and I would liken it to, effectively, you've got 43 forces throughout the country, so you've got 43 different businesses, and each joint branch board is its own entity.
Is it a business or is it a public service?
No. I'm using the term as a business just to make it simple, just to simplify it. It's as simple as that. You have 43 different joint branch boards. Now, there's a number of regional representatives from all the regions, the 8 regions around the country, which send members to the centre to deal with all the everyday business of the National Police Federation. Now, what is going to happen, we're actually going to have what they're going to call a National Interim Board and a National Interim Council. That actually effectively gives the chairman and secretaries of the joint branch boards locally more say in what goes on with the federation.
Now, you do negotiations with the Home Office over things like pay. How have they been going?
As you probably, or you will be aware, we've been given a 1% pay rise this year. It's what we expected. We didn't expect anything else. It's the public sector, and, I think we've been very lucky to get that.
What about this whole business of direct entry? We had, I think it was Ian Wiley from the Superintendents Association a few weeks ago on here saying, well, as far as we're concerned, from the Superintendents Association, we are quite happy to have people from big business, Tesco's or whoever it is, coming into the organisation, so long as they're up to the job and they'll go through some sort of an interview process. We're also talking, of course, about having sheriffs from America coming over to be police chiefs here. But I understand that the police federation, that is inspector ranks and lower, are not so happy.
I think we're very much dead against it. I think if you liken this to the military, would you expect your troops that are in the trenches to follow the Tesco general manager over the ramparts into battle?
So what are the issues for you as the lower ranking police rather than superintendents and higher?
I think what you've got to look at is anybody that's going to be coming in at superintendent, chief superintendent level, they are going to be involved and in charge of various operations. And I would suggest the Stotscroft riots that we had a few years ago. They're going to be in charge of that. Well, if they've got no policing experience, how do we expect the troops to respect the decisions that are being made?
Well, that's a good question. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I know you had police in your family, didn't you? This is going to be a massive change for the organisation to have these people from outside the police force in charge. But isn't there actually quite a good argument that says, well, what we need is we need people from other parts of the world who've had an experience outside the police, because the police is too insular?
Well, I totally agree with Kevin and totally disagree with the policy. I think the fact is that things like policing or military or anything like that, you've actually got a local police officer in Bristol will have knowledge about Bristol which nobody else has got, even if they're from another part of the country. And I think this is what's the British policing system has always been based upon local police officers with local knowledge. And you can't bring somebody in from outside, and it's not appropriate to bring in somebody from outside. And the way Bristol does it is going to be possibly different from the way Reading does it. And that's not to say that they won't compare notes, but the idea that this is somehow transferable. I mean, in the United States, 11,000 people are killed with firearms every year, approximately, 3,000 of them by the police. Fortunately, that doesn't happen around here, and that shows why a sheriff from the US would not be able to work our system. Hopefully, our system's better than their system.
Kevin, you must concede that it is insular, the police, because, I mean, the whole way that it works is promotion up within the service. So when you make it up to a rank of sergeant or inspector, superintendent, even up to chief constable, people have worked their way up through the ranks. So it's a kind of bunker mentality that there isn't any kind of training or experience from outside the police force.
I would probably suggest to you, Tony, that if you've made your way up the ranks, have you not earned the respect of the people that will be below you? You know, I always look at all supervisors, and I will always class them as supervisory officers, not superior officers. They've actually earned the respect to be there.
How is this going to affect, I mean, obviously it's already affecting morale, it's a blow to morale, quite clearly, but how is it actually going to affect things day to day, do you think, in the coming, say, 18 months? Because, as we were saying a few weeks ago, the adverts were out there, probably the interviews have taken place now for our new outside the police force superintendents.
I'm waiting to see where it goes from now. Clearly, as you're aware, we've got a number of issues going on within Avon and Somerset. We've currently got a chief constable that's not present at the moment. This was his baby. He wanted it to go. I've said all the way through it's a half-baked idea, and we will see where it goes. I am aware that the selection processes have been taking place, and it will be interesting to see who the candidates are that come through.
It certainly will. And seeing if, you know, they're wearing an American sheriff badge as they're walking out to take on their new job in front of the press. Anyway, on another topic, Freemasonry. It's Friday the 13th, the old day of the arrest of the Knights Templar back in 1307 by the French King Philip the Fair. Really, I think it's fair to say that there's the same sort of suspicions put on Freemasonry today as there were in the Knights Templar in the days of yore. What are your thoughts about whether police officers should be declaring their membership of Freemasonry, Kevin? Because we've had several attempts to get this done, but apparently now all it is voluntary. Now, of course, everybody knows that if it's voluntary, people are just simply not going to do it.
I suppose I can probably say that my career's peaked now, so it won't matter what I say with regards to the Freemasonry. My personal view is it's not, it doesn't work with the police service, but if you try and ask people, and you quite rightly say there's been many attempts to get people to actually say whether they are Freemasons or not. I remember a number of years back where Avon and Somerset sent a list round asking people to actually write down whether they were Freemasons or not. Clearly you didn't get many volunteers on that one.
I mean, if I was a Freemason, I wouldn't write my name on there until I was actually told I had to write it, in which case I probably would reluctantly.
Yeah.
So what happened? Were there many people that did?
No, the majority of people that actually wrote on there were the people that weren't Freemasons, clearly.
And do you think this is actually an issue talked about amongst police officers? Do they sometimes wonder whether cases are dropped because of some kind of Masonic connection?
I would probably suggest that it's a lot less now than what it might have been in the past. I think genuinely the majority of people really don't care whether somebody's a Freemason or not. I can tell you an interesting story, because I actually went down to London this week, and I was sat on the train going to Paddington with full of lots of gentlemen in suits and everything else like that, and I was convinced to start with it they were a choir, and then it just hit me what they were, and they were all going down to a Freemasons convention in London.
It's interesting to hear how things have changed. Do you think there's any moves within the country, etc., for there to be more transparency about Freemasonry?
I think there's always going to be moves to make sure that happens, but how you actually impose it, because I think if you start trying to lean on people and make them to declare whether they're Freemasons or not, that will just drive it back underground again.
Well, possibly, but I mean, we've got this thing which goes right across the business community, and you were talking about the police as a business earlier on, and I suppose I'm hypocritically agreeing with you here, but you know, all effective businesses have a probity policy. Probity being, let's just be open about what our interests are outside this organisation. The only thing is, I've never seen one that actually includes Freemasonry in there. So they'll say, you know, tell us if you're a member of a club, tell us if you're a member of a professional body, etc. But never tell us if you're a member of a secret society. I just find that particularly shocking, especially after this revelation last week, that this chap Philip Judd down in Weston-super-Mare, who was the Tory mayor of Weston-super-Mare, deputy head of the North Somerset Council. Turns out he has been a Freemason, and one wonders whether some of those connections might have stopped prosecution in the future for, or sorry, in the past, for his participation in generating child pornography. But anyway, back to the police and policing. I'm always concerned about police morale. I want police to be enthusiastic about doing their job. What are the main issues for you at the moment, Kevin, other than we've just heard about pay and about direct entry, but other things that the police are worried about as to whether they can do their jobs or not in the future?
Well, clearly the big issue is the number of police officers. We're currently down to staffing levels of about the 1980s. And whilst the government mantra is the fact that the crime is coming down, it's not a case of crime is coming down, it's how it's recorded. And anybody can make figures say what they want.
Well, that's true. And also we heard recently, didn't we, from somebody, I think it was at the Home Affairs Select Committee, as a senior officer in London, was saying, well, actually, the figures are just made up. And then, of course, rather than them taking his evidence, the Metropolitan Police actually said, well, we're going to discipline him for saying something he shouldn't have said, even though he's being honest in front of all these parliamentarians. So is it true? Do you think sometimes figures are made up, Kevin?
Well, clearly, first of all, he obviously wasn't a Freemason, was he? What you've got to look at is it's the way the figures are recorded. I've been in the job long enough to see how it changes, how this is recorded as one thing. You know, I remember many, many years ago that we had a document, a form, which was criminal damage under £20, which went on an A4 sheet of paper and then was filed. Now, clearly, that dropped by the wayside, so that was never recorded as a crime. And it's just the way that crimes are recorded. And as I say, they can be made to say anything that you want.
Old Day Oxford economist Martin Summers, this whole idea of targets and target culture, I think, you know, we come across this in many areas nowadays, particularly in schools. It's not necessarily a guarantee, is it, that you're getting a better service?
No, and I think that the whole idea of, as it were, payment by results of the police force is the wrong way to think about it. All of this, you know, ticking boxes, you know, there's a certain amount of crime out there and you're being efficient if you solve it. And, of course, a lot of these people coming in from private industry solve it within a budget. That's what we're really talking about here, isn't it? People who've got experience of managing businesses, cutting costs and so on. Ultimately, if the police are being successful in their work, then crime will go down. But you don't at that point then cut the number of police officers. You actually say, well, that's good, carry on. And I mean, obviously, trust has got to be built with the community. But I think, you know, if police officers are now being subjected to what other public servants have been subjected to over the years, and they don't like it, and nor do teachers, doctors, and others who work in the public service.
Kevin, what are your thoughts about this target culture? Is it a bugbear of you, as it seems to so many police officers, and how does it work?
Throughout my career, target culture has always been a bugbear, because I've never actually played ball on that game. It has always been a bit of an issue for me. It used to be a number of years ago where it would be the number of arrests, the number of stop searches and everything else like that. That has now gone out of the window to a point. Undoubtedly, people are still monitoring what police officers are doing, but how do you monitor when a police officer has spent 4 or 5 hours with the wife of somebody that's just died? You can't monitor that. That's not a tick box. That is not something that you can actually equate to. And that is where it all falls down.
So how would you like to see things change?
I would like to have sufficient police officers actually out there working. I would like the police officers to increase in numbers. I appreciate that we're currently under, you know, budget cuts and everything else like that. I know we've got £23 million to save over the next few years coming up. Where that's going to come from, I don't know, because I think the cupboard's been stripped bare already.
Also, there is this matter of public confidence in the police being shaken quite badly over the last couple of years. We've had the Jimmy Savile scandal with police officers in Leeds actually having meetings every Friday with Jimmy Savile, I imagine, so that he could make sure he was keeping an eye on if there was anybody trying to get him prosecuted for what he was, which was probably the biggest child molester this country's ever seen. Then there's the Hillsborough scandal with a massive cover-up going on at Hillsborough over police culpability for actually causing that, and then we've got phone hacking with the police sitting on massive amounts of evidence of crime going on at the News of the World and the Sun newspapers, where where people's lives were being hacked, basically their phones, certainly, by what it seemed was a criminal gang going on permanently, really, in the News of the World newsroom, which is why the Murdoch paper had to close down. So there's a lot of pressure on the police to actually deliver, Kevin. And what would you say to answer those critics who are saying, well, the police are just not up to the job? Look at Hillsborough, look at Savile, look at phone hacking.
I think what we've got to look at is, we go right back to Robert Peel. And Robert Peel said the police are the public and the public are the police. We have to build that confidence there. We have to rebuild that confidence. You've touched on two historical issues there, the Hillsborough and the Jimmy Savile. I think what you've got to look at is the current police officers, the majority of the current police officers that are in forces now weren't even born when Hillsborough was there. You know, I can see that. I can remember Hillsborough. I actually remember watching it unfold on the TV, sat in front of the TV watching it. But many of the police officers that are in the service at this moment have got no involvement in those.
But I mean, for example, the Savile thing, he was interviewed not long before he died as well, but nothing was done about it. In fact, that was used as a reason for the BBC to, the Newsnight, to kill Liz McKean's report. The BBC editor of Newsnight was saying, well, the police have had a look at it and there was nothing to it, so we're not going to run this report. And obviously it's been the biggest scandal probably in the last couple of years, certainly in the world of child protection. So, you know, we're in a situation where it's not actually that long ago. I mean, though Savile, most of Savile's crimes were probably in the 60s and 70s. Even when he was still alive, the police were still, it seems, covering up for him, Kevin.
And clearly that is a very high-profile case. And as I say, the police service does have to rebuild that confidence with the public. It's something that we have to work at, and we have to work on a daily basis. I still don't think the majority of police officers out there are not doing the job. They're very good at what they're doing, and I'm still proud to be a police officer.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, there's a bit of a clash, it seems, coming, potentially anyway, with the less and less and less police around, more pressure being put on them to uphold the law, to do their job, but actually less police to do it. And also a bit of a breakdown in trust, it seems, between the public and the police.
Well, yes, I mean, they've just bought three water cannon, have they not? In the Met have just bought three water cannon, which in a way is almost like a red rag to a bull, in a sense, for potential rioters. And we're talking about scandals. Of course, the special demonstration squad based inside the Metropolitan Police was infiltrating environmental groups, basically, for 20, 30 years, and also the Stephen Lawrence campaign. And I'm quite sure that ordinary police officers didn't know nothing about what was going on. But quite clearly, I mean, the tactics we used, I would suggest, are completely unacceptable. They're giving people babies and then running away and leaving the people concerned with babies. This sounds like something from East Germany. But of course, the other thing I would say is that there's always been failures of policing. It's nothing new. The police aren't perfect. They were never perfect. Because of the nature of their job, they're constantly dealing with some pretty nasty people, and the temptation to fall in with those nasty people is always going to be there. And people shouldn't be surprised if police officers are found out doing bad things. It's a normal stuff, and the procedures should be in place to deal with it. That's all.
Also, Kevin, just give us an idea of the different sort of feels for different police areas, because, I mean, I don't imagine Avon and Somerset is quite the same as the Met, is it?
It most certainly isn't, and it's quite interesting because I was having a conversation with Sue Mount Stevens only the end of last week.
She's our Police and Crime Commissioner here.
That's correct, yes. And I was pointing out to her that it's not that long ago that we were in the top five most respected forces in the country. You know, Avon and Somerset had built itself up to have a very, very good name. We are not the Met. The Met is a totally different beast in itself. And
well, it's obviously bigger, but how is it different?
The whole setup is different. If you are looking at managing the numbers that the Metropolitan Police have got, it's just a totally, you know, it's like a separate country in itself with the numbers, and you've only got to look at it the way it's dealt with.
Now, Martin, I know, I mean, we've quoted several times on here from, I think it was Sir Paul Condon, wasn't it, who said actually he believed that there were quite a lot of criminal detectives in the Met.
Well, in the 80s, when he was first Metropolitan Police Commissioner, he gave a press conference. He said, I'll give you the bad news, some 200 of my officers are corrupt. The good news is we know who they are and we're keeping an eye on them. And people were sort of shocked by that, but he shouldn't be, really. I mean, in actual fact, there's always going to be a problem in any society at any time with police officers not doing as they're supposed to do, because they're dealing with crime, and crime is criminal. And the point is, do you have procedures in place for dealing with that situation? And I think the police service has come a long way since the 1980s, I think. Certainly, in a city, Bristol, where I live, I think the relations between the police and the community are the best I've seen them anywhere. And I used to live in South London for 15 years. And that doesn't happen by accident. It happens because a lot of good work has been done, changing of attitudes all round. Times change and we change with them.
That sounds like a bit of a rose-tinted view, because many people out there who are living on the poverty line actually see, well, sometimes the police are spending a bit too much time dealing with people whose actual problems are due to poverty. They're not due to the fact that they're willingly going out and committing crime. It's that, for example, they have to try and make a living somehow. They're either completely skint or they're stealing from a shop to feed their children. I mean, how do you deal with that, Kevin?
I think that's just one of the things that you're going to have to deal with. The police have always been notoriously known as the agency of the last resort. We are dealing with poverty. We are dealing with issues that social services should be dealing with. We are dealing with mental health.
Okay.
We are.
What I want to hear is, when's the first banker going to get arrested? And when are the first corporate tax fraudsters going to get arrested? I mean, they haven't messed around in Iceland. What they've done is they've gone in the various people who I could even mention Tony Blair, the war criminal. You know, when is he going to be arrested? So I think this is one of the perceptions that people have. And I think it's absolutely true to say that there is a glass ceiling with the law. And this is one of the reasons that people don't like the police, is because they can see people committing crimes on enormous scales, money laundering at the HSBC Bank, for example, in the billions, and not getting arrested for it.
Well, from my personal opinion, I would like to see the bankers dealt with the same as any other fraudsters. I genuinely believe that. If somebody has committed a crime, they should be dealt with, whatever.
Well, we've had Forex, haven't we? We've had the Forex fraud, Eurex fraud, apparently. This is another kind of fraud that they've been doing. And we've had interest rate fraud. We've had interest rate swaps. We've had PPI fraud. We've had money laundering. Mm. When are we going to start seeing some arrests, Kevin?
Well, I would like to think that those investigations have been going on and are going on. And as you can probably imagine, they are quite complex investigations. I've sat in on investigations that have gone on for 2 and 3 years with regards to people I've dealt with, so I know how it goes.
Well, maybe some dawn raids called for, like Rowan Bosworth Davis used to do, Martin Summers.
Yes, well, Rowan Bosworth Davis being a former fraud squad officer who we've had on this show. I mean, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime in 2009 issued a report, and of course most of their staff are police officers from around the world, and they said what happened during the 2008 crisis was the drug cartels all over the world came to the bankers and said, you need some money, we've got some, do you want it? And there was a big sucking sound, and all of the dirty money all over the world was just absorbed in one go into the banking system. That's how deep the problems lie, and that's possibly to do with the way the law works with drugs and so on. I think that actually creates an opportunity for crime. But crime is always going to be there. And are always going to be required.
We're talking about high-level crime. We're talking about war crimes. And we're talking about multi-billion-pound fraud by bankers. How are we going to actually move to the state where we're starting to see these people arrested?
There needs to be a political will to deal with powerful criminals, doesn't there?
Is that true?
There needs to be a political will from the top.
Surely the police should be just doing this kind of thing. They don't have to ask the politicians to whether they should arrest someone or not.
I think Martin's absolutely right there. There has to be a political will. You know, and I know that the bankers down in the City of London quite honestly feel untouchable, and you need to have a complete sea shift and a complete change on that as to how we're going to deal with it.
And when we're talking about political will, that means there's got to be political demand. You know, shows like this, we've got to say, well, something needs to be done. Politicians jump when they're pushed.
Okay, well, anyway, Kevin Phillips, Chairman of Avon Somerset Police Federation, thanks very much for joining us again on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, we are now going back to talk a bit about Freemasonry. And what exactly is Freemasonry? What's it about?
Well, if Freemasonry didn't exist, it would be invented. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations said, business people never get together, even on social occasions, without some kind of conspiracy against the public being cooked up. Now, in other words, those with wealth and power will tend to get together to advance their own interests. And Freemasonry traditionally, historically, has been the place where these people get together to discuss their business.
Well, we don't often hear vox pops about Freemasonry, but here's one from the 1980s, which was part of a Granada TV programme made by Martin Short, the author of Inside the Brotherhood. So let's see what people in the 1980s had to say about the Freemasons.
It's like a lodge, isn't it, where people go, you know, you want to get on a bit, you're a Freemason, aren't you, and you're Masonics.
Well, they're all over the place down here, everywhere you go.
Brother speaks for brother, don't they?
Yes. Secret society, yeah.
They shake hands.
Well, they're so secret we don't know what they do.
Yeah, they do, they stick
they've
to
got a
special,
another, don't they? Yeah, they've got a special ball shape. They wear silly leather pinnies and... No secret society. Probably fairly powerful, I should imagine. There's a lot of very wealthy people about here that are very interested in doing that sort of thing.
Bunch of bastards. To a man. The firm I work for is mainly run by Masons. Unfortunately, that led to a lot of people who aren't particularly good at their job getting into influential places.
What sort of firm do you work in?
I wouldn't like to say, especially on the camera.
I think actually the last chap there, Martin, makes one of the best points, which is that it's about privilege and promotion. And people who aren't actually very good at their jobs, but they're very pliable and they're very obedient, get put into these positions of power. I mean, you look across the country now, you can see this in many, many places. I'm not saying it's necessarily due to Freemasonry, but it seems that there is a definite shift away from the idea of having independent-minded people running things to people who are obedient and pliable.
I think that's always been the case, Tony, is what you'll find. It's as bad now as it's ever been. And the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. We've got to keep our eye on all of these things all the time, because the potential for people to abuse power is always going to be there.
Anyway, I asked you earlier on, a bit unfairly maybe, what is Freemasonry, since you're not a Freemason, you're not an expert. But I did also ask, a couple of years ago, I asked Martin Short, who's the producer of that film, Inside the Brotherhood, and also Martin wrote this book, Inside the Brotherhood 2, I asked him, what is Freemasonry, Martin?
I don't give the impression that however many Freemasons there are in this country now, or a good deal less than it used to be, that they're all policemen. In fact, Freemasonry is full of people in many walks of life, and also, by and large, these days dedicated lodges for police officers would not be encouraged, though there is in fact one called the St. James's Lodge in central London, which is entirely staffed by police officers. However, in an average lodge, you might get people from any walk of life, and in among them might be a police officer. Now, it would be a sore temptation, bearing in mind the oaths of mutual defence and support that Freemasons undertake, if you were in trouble, whether it's over a parking ticket or a drunken driving offence or, you know, some punch up with a neighbour, you know, that you might hope that you could turn to a brother as a Mason in distress, and favours would follow, that maybe bits of paper could be lost and you could avoid prosecution. I think that's a bit more difficult these days, but of course what used to be common practice, you can't be absolutely sure doesn't happen now.
What about the City of London? Because I know back in the 1980s you had a good look at the death of the banker, Roberto Calvi. Now, a lot of people now are looking at the City of London and thinking, can we trust the banking fraternities, and can we trust these big investment banks that seem to have such a lot of power over our futures at the moment?
There is absolutely no doubt that Freemasonry used to be extremely strong in the City of London. We obtained a lodge list of all the Lord Mayor's Lodge in London, and universally, one after another, over about 70 years, the Lord Mayors of London were masters of this lodge. In fact, some of them were initiated only after they had become Lord Mayor. Unfortunately, I haven't been blessed by being handed another copy of the Guildhall Lodge members list.
Well, that was Martin Short there, author of Inside the Brotherhood. Martin, what are your thoughts about the City of London and Freemasonry? Because it's certainly a lot of the sort of Masonic symbolism is involved in places like the Guildhall in London, where the city grandees and all the livery schools meet. There seems to be quite a big tie-up, and Martin Short is also saying that, you know, there's certainly in the past, we know that many people in the city were Masons.
Yes, but I mean, as I suggest to you, the powerful groups will always create clubs where they can fix things behind the scenes. So you've got the Knights of Malta, for example, a similar organisation to the Masons, but even more secretive.
And Also, let's have a listen now to some of the culture, because I know I was listening the other day to one of the commentaries on the Sweeney film, and some of the people who were the writers of the Sweeney, another bit of British culture film made in the 1980s and late 70s, and one of their first assistant directors had quite a lot to say about what he felt was quite a lot of Masonic influence in the police that they'd come across and within the judiciary researching their film, and actually provided some of the backdrop to the Sweeney as a drama series.
I think Callahan brought in his first sort of Race Relations Act in the 60s, you know, a little bit ahead of when we were doing this. They had to leave the police out of it because the police were not prepared to be told how they should behave in terms of race relations. And I went to, as we all did, you know, some of the do's, and there was this sort of, I thought, rather unhealthy alliance between the bar and you know, barristers who worked at the criminal bar, and they're all criminals, aren't they, and judges and senior police officers. You know, it was kind of like a, well, I think to no small extent it was Masonic, but I mean, there was certainly a sort of Freemasonry in terms of the way they reacted and related to each other. And we did hint at that, didn't we, in this from time to time?
Yeah.
I think we pushed it as far as we could. I suppose we all, at that time, and still, you know, one resents the kind of self-censorship that the establishment imposes on television, the creative television people, isn't it? You know, you end up sort of censoring yourself, because that's the only way you can get it through.
Yeah. You end up censoring yourself because that's the only way you can get it through. Well, that was one of the first assistant directors, with mumbling in the background, Troy Kennedy Martin, the deviser of the Sweeney programme. Also, Martin, we just heard last week, Derbyshire County Council members must declare Freemasons membership. Now, it's really just because the council has switched allegiances with the local voters who have voted in a Labour administration, and they said, right, we want everyone in this council now, if they're a Freemason councillor, to declare their membership.
Well, that's the obvious way to deal with all of this, isn't it? Transparency. If there's nothing to hide, what's the problem with telling everybody that you are one?
That was an article I spotted in the Derby Telegraph, but in the Derbyshire Times, a different one, we get a couple of days later, a Tory leader has avowed to fight the policy dictating that councillors must declare their Masonic membership. Anyway, that's all for now. This is Tony Gosling wishing you a happy and enjoyable weekend, and don't let those banksters get you down. We are online at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
93.2 online and on your mobile. BCF.